Up next, we've got Christian Clemenson, who's going to speak to us about machine learning in pricing models. Christian is a senior director at Willis Towers Watson, being responsible for the non-life activities in the Nordics since 2011. He also has a wider role of looking after the software sales in select markets, which is why he travels to South Africa from time to time, and some people might have seen him here before. He holds a degree in actuarial science from the University of Copenhagen, and before joining Willis Towers Watson, worked in the Nordic insurance industry for more than 15 years. He's a fellow of the Danish and Swedish Actuarial Associations. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you, and thank you for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation to come and speak today. Impressive number of people. I'm a bit unease standing in front of a Deloitte sign speaking today, so please don't post anything on Twitter or LinkedIn. Millerman, I think you can't see that one. Also, one disclaimer, I don't have any mentioning of nude or sexy nudes or pornography in my speech, or I just managed actually to put them in, so. Being a consultant, I'm moving to a slightly more colorful cover slide. In Willis Towers Watson, we work in consulting insurance companies, and in that we also consult on machine learning. We're, of course, known to be kind of backbone GLM people. We sell software. But because we also sell software, it means that machine learning becomes relevant from a development perspective. And we've already taken measures in that respect. So, talking about machine learning, it means different things to different people, and who's interested in what, this is the heading here. In the news, it's typically around autonomous cars or a computer learning itself how to play Go. That's what seems to get the most attention. Today's talk is going to be more like solving regression-type problems and classification-type problems. Rather more boring, one could say, but hopefully in this audience, a bit of interest as well. This talk is primarily about machine learning and pricing. So that's also the title of the talk, so no surprise there. But the application of machine learning in insurance is already more broad than that, and quite much so. I don't know why it seemed to have landed in the remit of pricing for some reason, but there must be some sort of perception, and I was happy to see the count before the convention started, that so many pricing people are here today. There must be a perception that pricing holds the most complex analytical problems in an insurance company, and therefore machine learning just dropped in that box. But really, a lot of other stuff is going on, and the first project actually we have in the Nordics covering machine learning is within claims, and we do a counter-fraud claims modeling using topic modeling with a Swedish client. So I'm going to talk about pricing, or mainly today, but be aware that it's applicable in a lot of other areas in insurance. None of this is new, actually. So we've had GLMs for quite a while, and it's kind of evolved over a line from having a very few factors over data enrichment to use GLMs in demand models and so forth. And the recent, let's say, tide of data enrichment is only the latest development. But other non-GLM methods have actually existed for that entire period. And I think some of the models we're going to show on the screen today is dating back to the 1950s. So why is all of this then in so much vogue as at the moment or during the last couple of years? That has perhaps mainly to do with what's in the hexagonal boxes, and I don't know if you can read all the text from the last row there, but there's still free seats up front. But open source environments has a lot to do with it. So say R or Python These are now available to the entire world, not just insurance companies who buy software, and perhaps the common libraries that are built in that environment. Of course, also computational resource and scale. We can now fit more data than we could in the past without spending a whole day doing it. And lastly, but not leastly, and we'll come back to that during the talk, the presence of data, both internally in companies, you store more data now than ever, but also open source data or public data that can be retrieved through different sources. So this is not new, and it's been around for a while. Today, I'm going to talk only about a subset of models, and there are many more that exist already, and I think I'm not the only one thinking that many more will be developed and exist in the future. And actually, we also talk to clients about developing new models, making up new models, bespoke models to cover to solve specific problems. I think that's going to be prevalent in the future as well. What I'm going to do today, after this annoying slide finisher, is pick out a couple of these. Sorry, I was looking for the word animation. Pick out a couple of these to talk about, because I haven't got much time and I don't want to eat too much into your coffee break. And if I do, then blame Emma. No, pick out just a few, and I'm talk more about if and why they're relevant than the actual models themselves. So if you came today just to learn about the interesting math in machine learning methods, I'm going to disappoint you. Okay, before we dwell into to what's up, how many has heard of the site Kaggle? Oh, a fair few. Anyone competing on Kaggle? Oh, one or two. It's really, so for those of you who didn't raise your hands, it's really a site where you can compete in building the best models for public problems. So companies or others can post problems on this website, and data scientists and apparently actuaries can contend in getting the best model to fit that specific problem. The thing is here that I think most of the times the problem is anonymous, or it's not revealed what we're actually trying to fit. So domain expertise in this respect becomes irrelevant. And I'm going to come back to the case of domain expertise. So what you're basically doing is competing on finding the best method for a given problem. But, and this is perhaps the key message for today, so be awake on this slide and then you can go back to sleep. Is it really all about the method? And the answer is obviously no, because otherwise I would not have asked that way. We think that data is actually what you start with. When doing machine learning, you start with data. This is also a big thing, and I mentioned there's more and more of it. So what you do is trying to source as much of it as you can with the most breadth from the maximum number of sources to be able to have as many variables as possible to predict a given response. This is not my personal opinion. It's also my personal opinion, but it's kind of what we tout to clients. And secondly, we don't go to models yet, is factor engineering and defining of response variables. It's actually quite important with the vast amount of data you have available at the moment to think about what your factors should be and what a meaningful response is. An example of response could be if you're trying to model the effect of parking sensors on claims, you shouldn't be modeling accidental damage, you should be modeling parking claims. It's quite obvious, but we tend to model what we always model. We have third-party liability with accidental damage and so forth. But actually, think a bit about this is crucial, and that's where domain expertise actually come into play. And then only after you've done these two first steps, we think you should go to methods. And it's a very small blob, and it's even shaded to make it more visual. First, you do the data. You think about the data. Then you do the factor engineering response variables. And then you can begin to think about which methods actually solve your problem. So we talk a very short bit about data before we go on to the real topic, which is actually models. An area where we're used to is actually having an abundance of data is motor insurance. So either in the old days, as was said in the introduction, I've been around for a while. In the old days, you ask the client, what is the horsepower, what is all this? And after half an hour, you came up with a price. But these days, you can get these either via the plate, the registration plate, or other open source data vendors. In the UK, we have a collaboration with, I can't remember the name right now, but basically, repair shops providing data to a data vendor who then sells it on about claims on the car. And claims, it sounds stupid because we have claims already, right? No, we don't, because not all claims are reported. And I think, especially in South Africa, looking at the car park, it seems like not all cars, all claims are reported. So that's actually quite valuable to know. And this follows the car. It doesn't follow the driver, it follows the car. So it's actually quite valuable to know that this car actually has 15 repairs that weren't reported to the insurance company or the insurance industry. But what is important now, so not only motor insurance but the wider space, is that you're able to organize all these factors into manageable groups so you can do a good model. As I gave one example about factor engineering and response variables. This is another one. But in the UK 10 years ago, they had a big problem with body injury claims in motor. And someone found out that there was a division in what people claimed. One is called, we call it insurance risk, and the other one is kind of diplomatically called compensation risk, which is when people claim for something they didn't suffer. So just thinking of that response, dividing the models just into two models. We're modeling one and the other. And from these, I think many people in the room are familiar with emblems, so these are not that marketing slides as they could have been. But these are emblem. You can see that the responses are different, or the predictions, sorry, are different. That's just an example. Okay. I said that methods were the least important to think about, so now I'm going to spend the rest of the talk talking about methods. Also, that wouldn't have been fair to the title I gave. So we got the context right, and I think in Willis House, what we find that different models are valuable and useful for different places or for different problems. And that is perhaps also a key message. How do you then measure whether a model is good or bad? And you would typically have your own favorites. You have a root mean square error or a chi key or whatever. All kinds of metrics are around. A typical one is Gini. So I won't go into too much depth of the Gini coefficient, but basically ranks the observations and then measure how good the model predicts this cumulative exposure, sorry. And a better model will give a higher Gini coefficient, which is kind of illustrated by the yellow area. So we take a good old-fashioned GLM, we fit it, and we get a Gini coefficient of 0.327. What does that mean? I think it's very difficult to tell. I can, as an actuary, come with a new model. And what does that mean? Is that better or worse? Well, it's better in terms of Gini. It's a higher coefficient. But how much better is it? Is it significant? I can do the percentage-wise improvement, and what does that say? Is it good or bad? It's better, but how much? So, of course, then you can try and do a bit of a sensible thing. You take your GLM, you remove a minor factor, and you get a 1%... I can't find the word. The opposite of improvement to your GLM. Or you do a major factor and take that away, and you can say it doubles the decline in genium factor. So to kind of say, so 1% is equivalent to removing a minor factor from the model. But, and I don't know how popular the Muppets are in South Africa, I used to, or Sesame Streets, or whatever it's called, I used to watch them when I was a kid. So Count von Count, just using that to illustrate, if you take a model, you multiply it by 123, you square it, and you add 74.5 billion, you actually get the same Gini coefficient. So you can do a really rubbish model and get the same Gini coefficient as a good model. It's just a word of caution. Of course, this only goes if you have a monotone function. It comes from the ranking of the observations. What we tend to do when looking at this, whether a model is good or bad, and again, Emblem users will be familiar with this, is a double lift chart. So you have a new model and an old model, or proposed current model and proposed model, and then you rank the difference in predictions from these two models and order them in deciles or in bands, and then you take an out-of-sample test and see how well the models perform to the observed. And it's clear here that the new proposed model is following the observed better. So we accept this to replace the current model. And we tend to think that there's a better way of doing it than just looking at a coefficient. But for this purpose and for this talk, we would like to have a coefficient anyway. So what we could try and do is take this double lift chart and associate a financial value estimate instead. So we'd have to do some assumptions about elasticities, but then having done those assumptions, we can actually say and calculate the actual estimate experience in out-of-sample data. And that then gives a loss ratio instead of a Gini coefficient. So going back to the scale from before, we can see that this new model I've put two elasticities here, so six could be the UK market, and two could be the European market, and I don't know where, South Africa, perhaps somewhere in between. And there we see that in this case, on a low elasticity basis, you actually get the same improvement as you do measuring by the Gini. So 1% improvement, or yeah, it's half of that, sorry. Of course, this measure is correlated with a Gini, as shown by this graph, but not completely. So you can get Gini improvement without getting any additional loss ratio improvement. Good. So let's suppose we've proven the value in terms of predictiveness, or we have not. It depends on how well we did the estimation or the modeling. What else do we consider? So predictive power is, of course, very important when doing machine learning modeling or other models in general. There seems to be some nervousness about not being able to explain what's driving the price to your clients. Anyway, when we talk to clients, there is. And perhaps less of that if you're only talking about machine learning driving components of the price, so a customer lifetime value or other elements of it. But certainly, there are different things to consider, and the first one I mentioned going clockwise is the interpretation bit. Are you willing to not be able to explain the price, where it's coming from, to clients or indeed management or your boss. Then there's a dimension of table implementation. So how do you implement your rates? Typical way of doing it still is via tables, and very few, if any, machine learning models are implementable that way. Stability is also an issue. So what happens if you change your parameters or hyperparameters a little bit? Does the model prediction swing widely? Execution speed is particularly interesting if you're doing point-of-quote quotations, and many of them. You have to give a quote right away, and you can't wait for a tree to fit in two minutes. And finally, the analytical time and effort, and where you guys come in, how much time does it take in the back room to actually fit these models? If you only have a third-party liability and an accidental damage model is perhaps not that important, but if you have 50 models to fit, it becomes an issue how much effort needs to go into these. Okay, coming from a company with a GLM backbone, so to speak, it's not surprising that we think that the GLM is green on most of these dimensions. Of course, also being mindful of having a good software, not mentioning any names, and especially also on the analytical time and effort. I mean, that's still the only yellow, amber, red bubble, but on the execution speed, of course, very good at implementation. Those are basically relativities, goes directly into a table structure. Which models do you then use where? And then I said in the introduction I'm going to come back to domain expertise. And there's balance between data scientists and actuaries, or perhaps not the right way of saying it, because actuaries can also be data scientists. But if you have insurance people with domain expertise, we think that's a very important thing to throw into the process when doing machine learning. So going back to the Kaggle, it's not just throwing a model at a problem. It's a matter of finding the right data, responses and factors. So that's an important takeaway from today. Okay. Being conscious of time, I'm only going through two methods and then not in very much detail. So if we focus on trees for a very short time and just take a simple tree example, where I've just plotted an underlying trend here, and what a tree actually does, you have a split, and then you fit according to that split. Sorry. So if you have one splitter, you get this, not very good approximation. If you have a second split, you get this, it's not very good either, and a third split, and so on. So that's the basic notion of trees. They do have some shortcomings, and I didn't know about the price before I came here, but actually I did estimate, perhaps that's not viewable either from the back row, but this is actually the feedback score depending on the number of equations in your talk. Trees might miss such interactions and just go for the average. I guess the interaction here being actuaries, non-actuaries, also not that irrelevant because I think you're all actuaries. They're also struggling with categorical variables. So here I've plotted the feedback score depending on first initial. And you can see, I didn't make this up, but C is actually scoring quite high on this one. So, and I have two C's in my initials, so it should be scored double as high. But a tree might just be picking that up, even though it's noise, and fitting a trend to that, if you have sufficiently many splits. And they can be bad at turning points as well. The last one was the slide satisfaction per word count. But they can be pretty easy to interpret. I mean, the tree structure is easy to interpret. Quick and dirty, good for quick and dirty solution, and useful as an early diagnostic tool. Then I'm going to move on to number one topic of our meetings with clients, and that's gradient boosting machines, or GBMs for short. I don't know how many have heard of that notion here in South Africa. Anyone using it in anger? Perhaps you're not willing to say so in public. That's perfectly all right. But I did see a hand or two. So what a gradient boosting machine is all about, a GBM, is really just a sum of trees. So you take a sum of a whole lot of trees, and you have to define some hyperparameters, one being the learning rate, or the shrinkage is how much of the iterated tree you actually add to your model. You have to choose an interaction depth, so number of splits allowed, and then the number of iterations or the number of trees. And finally, the back fraction is how much of the data you're fitting in or fitting to in each iteration. So you can do random sampling from the data. We're doing a simple example again, which is just one factor, is the same underlying trend as before, using an interaction depth of 1, which is kind of simple step functions, and a learning rate of 10%, so the lambda is 10, and we use the entire data set in each iteration. And what you get is, so you get the same here in the first, and then you add 10% of the first fit. So the slightly more shaded yellow at the bottom. You add that to your fit, and then you do a second. Those are the residuals. And then you do a second fit, and you add 10% of that to the model. And perhaps it's easier to do with this one. You go on and you learn as you go, hence the learning rate, and you get the blue, which is the predicted, gets closer and closer to the underlying trend. And after a good many iterations, so 1,000 iterations, you actually get a perfect fit. How do you calibrate these assumptions? You use N-fold cross-validation, not going into too much detail about that. So what does a GBM look like? Well, very obvious, it's very intuitive, but no, there are actually many of them, and there are many more of them, and in the end, it looks something like this. And how do you explain that to a regulator, or a boss, or a client? Does it work? And how does it work? So we can go back to the measurement scale from before, and actually we do find significant improvement in using a GBM over GLM, both on the measuring on the Gini scale and on these loss ratio bases, or less so on a list elasticity 2, so a lower elasticity environment. You could also add something to this. So ensembles is just a French word of average. So you can add a GBM and a GLM, or taking some average or mean between the two. And you actually get even better results on a Gini scale. Measuring on a loss ratio on a financial scale, you actually don't get much value out of it. So the Kaggle people get really excited, but the business doesn't really care about this. What if we do take a GBM? I mean, those are different to fit, or sorry, to implement in your rating study. We could try and fit down a GLM to the GBM predictions. So then we get back to our predictions, or sorry, relativities and a known structure. It seems like you actually, in a Gini world, you don't get far, but in the financial terms, you get roughly a third of the way in both elasticity terms. Now, there is a bit of a disfavor to GLMs here, because GBMs are allowed to go wild here. They're just fitting. They can use any higher order interaction they could find. So it's not really a fair test. The GLM, they might miss the higher order interactions because the modeler didn't know how to fit them. So what we're saying is we're really not comparing like for like here. What we try and do to let's say, level the playing field is, what if we'd let the GLM fit automatically? So also searching for higher order interactions. And this is just a graphic showing a saddle interaction. Then actually we do get a bit further, or a bit closer to the, let's say, current best results. Especially if we look in a low elasticity environment, you can see you're almost all the way to the GBM and the ensemble. It seems like a higher elasticity world and Gini world, we are still a bit behind. Back to this one, and how does it work, and can we interpret these results? Just one comment here, conscious of time. It's viewing a new world through an old lens. So we're used to looking at relativity charts and that, and so forth. Now we have something similar. We could use partial dependency plots or ice plots or what have you to be able to interpret what's going on and perhaps catch some interactions. That's what's going on in the bottom left corner with the coloring. That's because there might be an interaction present that we've missed. It is a challenge to interpret these results in a way that we are used to. Finalizing with GBMs, we actually think they're very good predictively. Unfortunately, difficult to interpret, as I said. They're difficult to implement, and the execution speed is also lagging, especially if you have very complicated trees and a lot of them. But of course, if you have a modern rating engine, then implementation gets a lot easier. Sorry for that. Move to the next slide. I've talked a little bit about few of the models, two to be honest. But as I said in the beginning, a lot of these exist out there. And the key takeaway would be that the different models have different advantages and disadvantages. So it is really important after the data exercise and actuarial domain expertise has been applied to think about the problem you're trying to solve and which method is best suited for that. And perhaps even take in the business need and in the model you're trying to apply and the problem you're trying to solve. We see too many clients who kind of have a strategic objective to do machine learning in one form or another, be it because of executive pressure or the hype around it, or just employees wanting some fun to do. We often see there are more important things to fix first. This could be within your current models or just using more of the data you have available or using data enrichment. So actually, quite often, there's more value to fixing the house order first before moving into this field. But once you understand the data, understand the business need, then you can go to the next step in saying, what does machine learning help us attain? I have two slides on in conclusion. So, and these go to a high word count, so that draws down my feedback score. Sorry for that. There are many forms of machine learning models, as I've shown already. It seems that new data and feature response engineering generally add more value. I said that before, so I'm just repeating that here again. But we also do need to continuously monitor what's going on with new methods and within the development of those. As I pointed out with the Gini curve, traditional measures of prediction value might not always reflect what's happening in insurance. And it's not all about the predictive power anyway. You also need to be able to compute in time and to implement and so forth. In terms of GBM, which I spent most time on talking about today, they can actually provide some predictive lift, mainly because they can capture higher order effects. But are you actually willing to not be able to explain what the model does or see what the model does? and just use some broad diagnostics in terms of the effort required to understand these higher order effects in a short time span. Business leaders and regulators, I mean, in the US they have to file rates. How do you file a GBM? It can be quite difficult. And then the last two, do you have the software and hardware to fit large data sets and also a rating engine that can implement GBMs? I think those, there's actually a final slide as well. I think I'll skip that. In terms of, I've talked about machine learning, and some of you might say this is not really machine learning. Going back to the very first slide with the Go board, in terms of true machine learning, so computers teaching themselves how to price a risk without any human intervention, we haven't actually seen that deployed yet, or perhaps some murmuring about research in that area. But the true machine learning, if you, the essence of machine learning word, we haven't seen that deployed yet. And I think that's probably a bit further out. And we need to understand the models better before we go there. Okay, on that, and conscious of time again, we have 10 minutes less back, the remaining of the coffee break. I think I'll stop here and say thank you again for having me and for the invitation. Yeah, I can also pull on my glasses so I can actually read that one. Why consider the Gini if what you really care about is a loss ratio? Yeah, I think that's what we're saying, right? The Gini is just a traditional measure, and that's used in machine learning, Kaggle land, whatever. We would look at either double lift charts, as I showed one slide, or going further from that, attaching a financial value to that estimate. So I completely agree, and sorry if I didn't make that statement. Please give another brief explanation. So perhaps I can go back to that slide. No, so what you're trying to achieve is you have your predictions on a good on a new and a proposed model. You know what the predicted loss ratio is predicted frequency and severity are for each. If you, and you know the actual experience on the out-of-sample data, you know the loss ratio on the out-of-sample data. If you then use the new model to predict the loss ratio of the business you actually get, and you use some form of elasticity measure to predict the volume you get from that business, then you can get a loss ratio from the new model and compare that to the old model. And the percentage difference in the slides were than the difference between the two predictions. Oh, I got a marketing question. How nice. I don't think we have any Whittlesnails Watson employees in the audience, so it must be a genuine one. Are we considering building other machine learning methods besides GLMs into the emblem? So I wouldn't consider GLM to be a machine learning methods, but if it meant to be GBMs, so GBMs already built in, not into Emblem, but into Radar, which is a similar software suite, and in not so distant future, they will actually be the same, so Radar and Emblem. Right now, it's only GBMs in there, but we are currently building more into it, and actually, in Radar, you can consume machine learning methods from other software, so R, for instance. So you can import that into Radar. Once you imported that into Radar, you can deploy it directly if you have a rating engine that we also sell. Sorry. I'm still standing in front of the Deloitte sign, so I'm allowed to say that. Are data scientists going to take over the pricing actuary roles or even move into reserving? A careful yes to that one. Well, take over is perhaps overdoing it. Certainly, data scientists and the like will have more to bring to the table in an actuarial problem. You don't need an actuary to fit a GLM, actually. you perhaps need an actuary to help build the GLM. And I think it's back to the slide I had previously. It is a little bit about domain expertise, how you structure the data, which data you put into the mix, how you define your responses and engineer your variables. So I don't think they will take over. I certainly think they have more to bring to the table, and I think that perhaps also actuaries should re-educate themselves in the fields of machine learning and artificial intelligence in order to be able to actually participate in that as well. Okay, we've run out of questions and we've run out of time. So thank you once again. Enjoy the rest of the conference.